William Arnold, a man of 60, sat stiffly in a chair in the living room wearing his World War I uniform. He had been a captain in that war, and he had become a captain again, briefly, before he shot himself through the right temple with a Colt 45. There was no blood in the room when they found him. He appeared almost ludicrous, sitting there with a clean, dry hole in his head.
"Crazy," he said. "Stark, raving, mad."
Stone nodded. Some of them died instantly, and others went quietly nuts. It was then they heard the sound of crying. It was not far, two houses up the right side. A man and a woman lay outside on the sidewalk, fallen and clutching their chests. They ran past them and into the house. The crying was still louder. It filled the empty rooms. They hurried upstairs, clambering up, and came to the bedroom. A large double bed, unmade. A dresser, a mirror, a closet, and a small crib. They leaned over, pulling back the blankets from a small, very red-faced, very unhappy infant boy. The baby immediately stopped crying long enough to survey their faces, enclosed in the plastic suits. Then it began to howl again.
"Too bad," Burton said. "He can't tell us what happened."
"I'm hoping he can," Stone said. Back in the center of the main street, they signaled for the hovering helicopter to descend with the ladder. Burton held the infant, and Stone held the Scoop satellite. Strange trophies, Stone thought, from a very strange town. Suddenly, Stone realized that he was not alone on the street. He turned and saw a man behind him. He was an old man, with thin gray hair and a wrinkled, worn face. He wore a long nightgown that was smudged with dirt and yellowed with dust, and his feet were bare. He stumbled and tottered toward Stone.
"Who are you?" Stone said.
But he knew. The man in the pictures. The one who'd been photographed by the airplane.
"Don't hurt me. I'm not like the others."
He was shaking with fear as he stared at Stone in his plastic suit.
"Don't hurt me."
"We won't hurt you," Stone said. "What is your name?"
"Jackson. Peter Jackson, sir. Please don't hurt me. You know I'm a sick man."
He faltered and then doubled over, clutching his stomach. And then he vomited. It came up heavy, deep red, rich with blood. "Mr. Jackson." But the man was not awake. His eyes were closed and he was lying on his back. For a moment, Stone thought he was dead. But then he saw the chest moving slowly. They used the power winch to hoist up the unconscious body of Peter Jackson, and then lowered it again to raise the capsule. Then slowly, Burton and Stone climbed the ladder into the belly of the helicopter. The pilot established a radio connection to Vandenberg so that Stone could talk with Major Manchek.
"What have you found?" Manchek said.
"The town is dead. We have good evidence for an unusual process at work."
"Be careful," Manchek said. "This is an open circuit."
"I am aware of that. Will you order up a 712?
"All right," Manchek said. "I'll put through the order."
Directive 712 was part of the final wildfire protocol for action in the event of a biologic emergency. It called for the placement of a limited thermonuclear weapon at the site of exposure of terrestrial life to exogenous organisms. The code for the directive was cautery, since the function of the bomb was to cauterize the infection, to burn it out, and thus prevent its spread. As a single step in the wildfire protocol, cautery had been agreed upon by the authorities involved, executive, state, defense, and AEC, after much debate. The AEC, already unhappy about the assignment of a nuclear device to the wildfire laboratory, did not wish cautery to be accepted as a program. State and defense argued that any above-ground thermonuclear detonation, for whatever purpose, would have serious repercussions internationally. The president finally agreed to Directive 712, but insisted that he retain control over the decision to use a bomb for cautery. Washington came to a decision within an hour of Manchek's report. The reasoning behind the president's decision has never been clear, but the final result was plain enough. The president elected to postpone calling Directive 712 for 24 to 48 hours. Instead, he called out the National Guard and cordoned off the area around Piedmont for a radius of 100 miles, and he waited.